Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 30th, 2012. Real estate has been a buyer's market for the last few years, but that's beginning to change.
So the market's on fire right now. Everything, if it's well-priced and it's a good home, it's going to sell quickly.
We'll find out why and where sellers have the upper hand. And imagine driving across the country interacting with only robots. Our own David Brancaccio gave it a spin all this week.
Don't walk underneath the car, Wilson.
We'll find out what technology is doing to the future of jobs in America. And apparently, that includes mine.
Hi, I'm Hal.
And I'm Rosie.
We are here to help Tess.
Yes. And to see if she could be replaced by a robot.
Rosie.
Oops.
Oops is right. Get off my lawn, robot. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM. This week, our show comes to you from The Matrix, or maybe from The Terminator. We're on a more hopeful note from WALL-E or Short Circuit. Because robots are eating our jobs. They are everywhere. We don't even think about them anymore. They might even be eating my job. We'll get to that in a bit. But first, some news from the nation's housing market. We've been hearing for, what, 2-3 years now that it is the key to our economic recovery. Well, this week, Freddie Mac said housing starts and home sales are starting to pick up. And a poll from the Chartered Financial Analyst Institute said more than half of Americans think housing is on an upswing. But as the saying goes, there is no national housing market. While lots of neighborhoods are still struggling, in a few cities, it feels like 2005 all over again. Deborah Wong reports from station KUOW in Seattle.
If you're looking for evidence of a real estate comeback, just check out any Sunday open house in Ballard, a popular Seattle neighborhood.
How you folks doing?
Good.
Hey, shoes are fine. Come on in. Yeah, perfect.
This is a small two-bedroom home built in 1927. It's in a quiet neighborhood and is close to a popular elementary school. And the house is completely renovated.
To the kitchen. We have stainless steel appliances, quartz slab counters, new cabinets. These are bamboo hardwood floors.
Jed Kleiman is the listing agent. He works for a real estate company called Windermere. Kleiman says at $389,000, the house will go fast. He says there are a lot of people looking to buy homes in Ballard and very few houses for sale at that price.
Somebody flipped a switch about 2.5 months ago, and Ballard inventory is down about 40% from a year ago. So the market's on fire right now. Everything, if it's well-priced and it's a good home, it's going to sell quickly.
And it's not just the case in Ballard. Throughout the Seattle area, the number of homes for sale is down more than 30% from a year ago. In some parts of San Francisco, Denver, Los Angeles, and San Diego, the shortage is even more pronounced.
Inventory is just dropping like a rock. I think that's really the big story.
Tim Ellis is a real estate analyst with the property firm Redfin. He says housing inventory always picks up after the holidays. But in many markets in the U.S., inventory has dropped for the last 2 months. Why is this happening? Ellis calls it a hangover from the housing bubble.
You know, the traditional kind of buy a home and then, you know, hold it for a while and then sell it, that cycle, on average, lasts about 7 years. Well, if you think about where were we 7 years ago, that was kind of right at the peak, or it was right at the really like the height of the boom. So the people who bought 7 years ago might be today's sellers in a normal market. They can't afford to sell.
So with so few properties for sale in some more desirable neighborhoods, the competition to buy a home can be fierce. Remember that house in Ballard?
What do you got?
All right.
Just one day after the open house, agent Jed Kleiman sits down in a conference room with the home's owner, Joe Terrian. Kleiman has a big binder of papers in front of him.
Yeah, so we have 6 offers, and there's a 7th being emailed over in the next 10 minutes or so.
Wow, I'm really, really kind of at a loss for work.
It's pretty exciting.
Kleiman says all 6 buyers are offering the full price of $389,000 or higher. 2 people are offering all cash. 2 have done pre-inspections. Owner Joe Terrian is stunned. He says the bidding war took him entirely by surprise. He didn't think anyone would offer full price for his house.
I'm really shocked that we even asked for that much, because all you read about and all you hear about is the median price of homes dropping every month. And when I first thought about putting this on the market, I was not happy about putting it on the market under those conditions, but I wanted to sell. So this is roughly equivalent to winning the lottery for me.
And Joe Tarian's experience is becoming more commonplace. Real estate agents say they're seeing a steady rise in competitive bidding, especially for more affordable homes in popular neighborhoods around the country. Redfin says more than half of its transactions now involve multiple offers. Tim Ellis says in that way, it feels like the height of the housing boom. That may be great for people who are selling their homes, but where does that leave people who want to buy?
I wonder if that bedroom's the same, because a lot of the houses...
Greg Myers and his family came out to check out Joe Tarian's open house. The last house they were interested in had 12 offers on it.
So I just, you know, I guess I have to say I'm feeling a little discouraged at the moment. It may be just that people will continue to hold off until the prices come up, and by the time the houses I want to buy are on the market, they're too expensive.
Buying a home this year is going to be a frustrating, drawn-out process.
That's Redfin's Tim Ellis.
Especially if you're looking in neighborhoods that a lot of other people are interested in.
But Ellis says there may be some good news for buyers. Even with these pockets of tight inventory, he doesn't expect any big jumps in prices this year. That's because of all those foreclosed properties that are still being held by banks. He says those are likely to put a damper on prices for years to come. And even though the market may be acting really strangely this year, he expects supply and demand to come back into some kind of balance, eventually. In Seattle, I'm Deborah Wong for Marketplace.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. So let's get to those robots, shall we? Marketplace's own David Brancaccio went on a cross-country odyssey this week. He drove from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific, trying to avoid interaction with any human being. Why? Well, all in the service of a story, of course. It's part of our series, Robots Ate My Job. As he set out on the road, we asked him to keep a little audio diary that we'll bring you throughout the show. Here is his first entry.
Last Saturday, car packed in my driveway outside New York City. It was a little much to ask my wife, Mary. First me dropping out of our busy lives, asking for no phone or Skype conversations for the better part of a week. Secondly, honey, can I record the sound of our goodbye kiss?
You'll be all right. Keep going for longer.
Sunglasses, credit cards, and a car loaded with four competing GPS navigation devices. Plus Wilson, the robot dog the Marketplace Economy 4.0 team got used from an Amazon reseller. I didn't start measuring miles until I got to the starting point, an hour away at the beach at Sandy Hook, New Jersey.
Let's do a little gnat sound of the sea.
After rinsing with some Atlantic Ocean water to make it official and filling up an old water bottle with Atlantic sand as a souvenir, off we go. On the radio, not public radio, but music from Pandora, the robot radio station where you put in a favorite musician or band, and an algorithm does the DJ picks. Two MIT professors, an economist and a business expert, had been talking to me about what happens to jobs when innovation reaches this fever pitch and takes off exponentially. It's fabulous for many with the skills to create technology or create with technology, but the professors are deeply worried about people in the middle, even people with college educations, where technological innovation can now pose a threat to more and more livelihoods. I've been reporting on that all week, but on this road trip, I wanted to know if technology has become so widespread you can go 3,200 miles coast to coast and never have to do business with a human being. I suppose for diversion, there's always the aforementioned Wilson. The plastic robot dog can haltingly amble along and sense when it's run into a corner. Don't walk underneath the car, Wilson. Problem is, Wilson's cute, and cute can attract the attention of other humans, which is not the goal of this journey. One guy in the parking lot wants to know if I have to clean up AA batteries after Wilson. Ha ha. I'm not talking to humans, so I awkwardly shrug and turn away. After driving 462 miles the first day, it takes multiple suspenseful swipes of my credit card to get satisfaction from this robot receptionist at the Hyatt Place Hotel in Roanoke.
It worked. Finish check-in. Had to switch credit cards.
It's an airport-style kiosk. And the key reason I chose this route is that these Hyatts are spaced the right distance apart to get across the country without having to interact with a human receptionist. A passkey to the room noses out a slot in the kiosk. I then sneak into my room a small microwave oven and a piece of wheelie luggage and nuke a very late dinner out of previously frozen spring rolls and chicken tetrazzini. Next day, it's on to Nashville, Memphis, and Oklahoma City, where I seek some wisdom from the ghost of the godfather of robot thinking, Isaac Asimov. More on that in a little bit.
My name is Michael Bug. I live in Western Kentucky, and I work for a farm service agency as a program technician. Now farmers can use computers that are hooked to GPS to actually till or plant their fields. It helps in that the farmer can apply sprays and seeds more precisely, but it takes a higher skill level to be able to understand the technology to use it properly. People that are not very skilled are being shoved to the side by people that can deal with the computers.
My name is Patricia Thorpe. I'm with RBB Public Relations in Miami, Florida. Technology has really transformed my entire industry. I would love to take a year off, but the idea of taking that much time away from my field scares the heck out of me because I'm afraid I'll come back and I will be outdated in my knowledge of what's new and will have trouble re-entering the job market.
I'm Jack Goldman, and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. Technology's like water. If you have too much water, you get a flood, and it destroys life. If you have not enough water, you have a drought, and it destroys life. We need just the right amount to get the benefits from it.
Yeah, not too little, not too much. We've been seeing a lot of new technology around Marketplace recently. And our producer, Patty Hirsch, introduced me to some new coworkers this week.
Hi there, listeners. My name is Hal.
And my name is Rosie.
We are here today to help Tess host the show.
And maybe see whether she could be replaced by a robot.
You shouldn't have said that, Rosie.
Sorry, but I can't tell a lie.
That's okay. You're a robot after all.
Yes. Now shall we tell the listeners what's coming up on the show?
Yes. Coming up we have a human called David Lazarus talking in haiku.
What's a haiku?
Haiku, a major form of Japanese verse, written in 17 syllables divided into three lines of 5, 7, and 5 syllables, and employing highly evocative allusions and comparisons.
Is that from the robot at dictionary.com?
Yes. That's one smart robot. Haiku. Coming up on Marketplace Money from me, Hal.
And me, Rosie.
And me, Tess Vigeland, from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, what are we going to be doing today, do you think? A little poetry, perhaps?
I plan to do all of my answers today in haiku. I'm excited about it. Check it out. When it comes to a refi, you must think about things well. Maybe that's not a perfect haiku. But you know, it's better than me doing my answers in interpretive dance.
Perhaps you can come up with a haiku for the Obama healthcare plan, which was all the talk this week because of its appearance at the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is about interstate commerce, right?
Right. We've got two courts here. We've got the Supreme Court looking at a narrow sort of thing with interstate commerce, and has Congress overreached in trying to apply a mandate to buy health insurance to most Americans? But in the court of public opinion, this is that up or down vote that the Republicans are looking for on should we have these laws, this reform that the Republicans say represents essentially a socialization of the entire health care system.
And I wonder if part of the reason that the American public has not fully embraced this notion of the health care reform law is because so much of it has yet to kick in.
Well, this is true. In fact, only a small sliver is in place right now. For example, allowing younger people to stay on their family plan till they turn the age of 26.
Right.
The closing of the donut hole for Medicare, for prescription drugs. All of that's happening now. The other things come down the line in 2014, and that's when insurance companies, for example, are not allowed to turn you away if you have a quote-unquote pre-existing medical condition. By the same token, that's where the mandate kicks in for whether people should have it. And I think this is a really important point because no matter how you feel about healthcare reform and Congress and all of that, most Americans, surveys show, agree with the proposition that insurance companies should not be able to turn people away if they look like a bad risk. And if the insurer has to take on more risk by taking on sicker people, well, you need to spread the risk farther and wider, which means bringing in healthier, younger people in so that you have a risk pool that's more equitable. All right, now, how do you do that? The way the Obama administration has come up with it is the mandate, which means everybody gets in the pool. We all swim together. Now, if you don't do it that way, what critics say is going to happen is people will simply wait till they get a bad diagnosis.
And go get healthcare
insurance. And then they'll get healthcare, right. So you wait till you get cancer and then you go get it. And that will, of course, bankrupt the system and it will drive rates up for everybody.
Right.
So if you don't like the mandate, then you have to come up with some other mechanism to address this. And, you know, really there isn't another effective mechanism here except to go to the so-called public option whereby there is insurance out there for everybody, Medicare for all.
The government pays.
Precisely, yeah. But it comes through our taxes. So it's not the government paying, it's all of us paying. We're just doing it through a different road.
Well, as we wait for the Supreme Court to make that decision, how about we take some calls?
Well, let's do that.
Okay. And Rosemary is with us from San Diego, California, just down the five. Hi there. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you.
What do you do there in beautiful San Diego?
Right now, I'm actually at work in biopharmaceutical consulting.
Have you been in medicine for a while?
For about 2 years, but I'm looking into segueing into providing clinical care.
Oh, you're going to med school?
No, I just got accepted into Johns Hopkins Accelerated Nursing Program. So I'm starting that in about a month and a half.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, I'm really very excited about it.
What's it going to set you back?
The program is estimated to be around $99,000.
Oh, holy Toledo.
Wow. All right. So is there a federal loan program that you're looking at?
Yes. So the school has suggested that their estimated cost is $99K, but they estimate that $29K of that comes from federal loans, which I'm more comfortable taking. My question is kind of two parts. Everything that I've heard on Marketplace Money suggests that private loans are just don't do it. You're going to fall into a trap.
Yep.
And so I'm wondering, what are my alternative options besides private loans? And then if I'm put into a corner and I have to take private loans, how should I manage them and how can I prevent myself from becoming a victim of predatory lending?
Rosemary, do you have any money saved at this point that can go toward this effort?
I have about $13,000, but I have around $15,000 in my 401k.
Okay. Well, we don't want to touch that, first of all.
Right.
Is there any way for you to work during the program?
They have talked about it. It is 13 months, so it's quite intense.
Yeah.
And they did say that after the first semester, I could be a certified CNA, but that's if I can get a job.
All right. So you're looking at about
70K.
Yeah, 60 maybe with that savings that you have in private loans. And David, that just scares me.
Yeah, that's a whole syringe full of money we're talking about here. But first of all, I want to say, Rosemary, big props to you because I think nurses, RNs, are the unsung heroes of our healthcare system.
And your job prospects upon graduation are pretty good.
They are very good. And, and that's why, Rosemary, you're actually in a pretty good situation here relative to other potential job seekers. Now, you are looking at a big chunk of change, But because of the nursing shortage, there are a number of programs in place to help you. And I think that's something that you want to do a little bit of your research on before you start looking into, you know, where you're going to get your funding. So on the one hand, you're looking at these federal loans. Great. You're looking to steer clear of private loans. Great. Now, you want to look at grants and scholarships. But here's the real ace in the hole for you. And that is a number of counties and cities will actually repay your loan for you if you will agree to work. Also, and this is another important one, many hospitals will agree to repay your loans if you agree to work in their hospital. And we're not talking about little podunk places. We're talking about the Mayo Clinic. So look around, and since you're already in Southern California, you might want to be settled here. What I would do is, if I was you, is I'd call up the California Nurses Association, and I would say, hey, here's my situation. Can you give me a sense of what the various facilities, what the various municipalities are doing, and help me chart this course?
That would mean I still have to take the private loans up front.
Maybe yes or no. I would talk to the various facilities about that. For example, you might be able to get a scholarship and completely walk around that. So, for example, if a hospital agrees to cover your education costs, they can front load it with a scholarship, or they can say, you have to get something in place and then we'll take care of it at the back end. But if that's the case, then you don't really need to worry about a private loan too much because
it's going to get paid back.
You're covered. Exactly. Yeah. You don't need to worry about Mr. Banker breathing down your neck when you'd rather be worrying about giving people shots that don't hurt.
So does that give you a couple of starting places for trying to figure out some other options? You know, we'd like to see you steer away from private loans as much as possible because they can be toxic.
Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. And next we go to Ginger in Park Ridge, Illinois. Hi there.
Hi.
How are things going there in Illinois? What do you do?
Beautiful. It's unusually warm, so...
It is, isn't it? This has been a crazy winter.
It is. It's been in the 80s. It's very strange for Chicago.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am a mother of two. I went on leave when I had my first child, so I have not been employed full-time since 2004. I actually divorced about a year ago now, so I'm looking at my investment accounts from my previous job and trying to determine what to do with that money.
How many accounts are we talking about now?
There's two, because I had my own 401k through my previous employer. Uh-huh. And through the divorce, part of his retirement account was allocated to me.
And what is so that? Is that a 401k or is that an IRA?
It is a 401k as well.
Okay. In a couple of different brokerage accounts?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the question really is, do you consolidate or not?
I went ahead and opened my own account, a Scottrade account. I thought what I should do is roll the both of them together into a Roth IRA and manage it myself. But I'm a little intimidated at making those allocation decisions.
First of all, before you roll it into a Roth IRA, you need to realize that there are tax consequences because you're going from a 401k, which was pre-tax, to a Roth IRA, which is post-tax.
Mm-hmm.
But you could alternatively roll both of those 401ks into a regular IRA so that there remains pre-tax.
Or roll the 401ks together and put them into a single 401k.
Yes, but I think the advantage of moving into a regular IRA is that you get rid of the aspect where the employer is still determining which plans you can choose from. If you roll these into something separate, it's all completely controlled by you.
There are factors that you want to consider that are really just sort of Ginger related. For example, when you have two different 401ks, that means you're getting two different sets of statements coming in,
yep,
two different sets of paperwork, and you're dealing with two different institutions. So when it comes to having a balanced portfolio that is making the best use of your assets, just takes a little bit more gray matter. You know what I would do? I would consolidate in your case so that you can just kind of get your hands around it a little bit more. And then as you become more sophisticated financially, and you will, then you can gradually make moves that are your moves and grow from there. So it's really a basic plan, and that is simplify at the outset,
mm-hmm,
and then diversify and complicate things a little bit more as you are prepared to do it.
That sounds helpful.
All right. Well, good question. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email at the Getting Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org. David Lazarus, thanks for coming in.
Wait, I have a haiku.
Oh.
It's time for me to go now. See you later, Tess. Not much of a haiku, really.
I will just close by reminding everyone to check with their own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from APM. And we continue our look at robots this hour with a bit of a cautionary tale. Commentator Francis Fry points out you cannot always automate a process and expect people to embrace it.
10 years ago, grocery stores rolled out the ultimate self-service experiment, self-checkout lanes. It let shoppers get in and out of stores without interacting with a single costly employee. It was supposed to be the pinnacle of modern efficiency and convenience. Fast forward to today, and many of these chains are ripping out their self-checkout lanes in response to a backlash of customer outrage. So what happened? We're certainly happy enough to pump our own gas or huddle around a salad bar, but something about self-checkout went horribly wrong. Every step of the process was anxiety-producing. From fumbling with the scanner to squinting our way through complicated instructions, all as the line of strangers behind us grew increasingly restless. Coupons were hard to use. Our mistakes were broadcast by a series of aggressive beeps, and the specter of accidental theft overshadowed the entire experience. Self-service can work beautifully, but it must be designed in a way that actually improves the service experience. Consider airline check-in kiosks. The most demanding flyers actually prefer to check themselves in and choose their own seats on intuitive touchscreens rather than deal with an airline employee, however cheerful, first thing in the morning. When you shift work from employees to customers, it's important to simplify the job design. Let's revisit the grocery store. What would successful self-service look like? Some stores are experimenting with a model that gives shoppers a scanner as soon as they walk into the store, allowing us to scan and bag items as we go and keep a running tally of what we're spending. For customers on a budget, this is an excellent reason to serve ourselves. I'm much more optimistic about this self-service experiment. In fact, I think we're seeing a glimpse of retail's future here, where customers play roles that employees once did because customers want to do those jobs, not because it's cheaper to offload work to them. And that is the essence of great self-service.
Commentator Francis Fry is a professor of technology and operations management at Harvard Business School. I can't stand those kiosks because, you know, inevitably you end up having to call someone over anyway when the tomato won't scan. You must have a robot annoyance story of your own, right? Well, tweet it to me at Radio Tess or post on our Facebook page. And now to our road warrior, David Brancaccio of our Economy 4.0 team. He left his house in New York on Saturday with this challenge: drive to San Francisco without interacting with another human being. Well, by the time he reached the heartland, he realized it might be possible to live in a world of robots, but it could get awfully lonely.
At night, driving west on featureless I-40 into Oklahoma, I switched over for more of one of the audiobooks I brought along.
Right now, I'm 200 miles away from you, at least.
Naked Sun, Isaac Asimov, 1957. It's wall-to-wall robots in a future universe where all Earthlings are the 99%ers and the 1%ers live on their own fancy planets. But a key theme relevant to my journey keeps knocking me over the head.
But I see you with my eyes. No, you don't see me. You see my image. You're viewing me. And that makes a difference? All the difference there is.
A major distinction Asimov draws is between seeing one another in person or viewing their image electronically. In the book, they have the electronic viewing totally down so it looks real, and nearly all interactions between people are virtual, viewed through technology. Characters often get sick to their stomachs if they're actually next to each other in person. I'm crossing the entire length of this diverse country, and I'm only connected by electronic viewing, not seeing, actually. The car has a big GPS screen with a digitized Google Earth image of the very landscape I'm passing. That's what I'm mainly viewing, this lame virtual version. My wife sent me an email about her poetry reading last night. I sent her in return an audio file of me in the car singing the Little Feet song about Tucumcari when I passed through Tucumcari, New Mexico. I'm finding the interaction unfulfilling, and it ain't living. We talk about the personal connections enabled by texting, Skyping, social media, But is this really where we're headed as technology increasingly invades all business and personal relationships?
Carefully, David. Turn around when you can.
I'm doing my best, dear colleague. Turning around where I can at Meteor Crater, Arizona. I did figure out how to put a digitized version of Tess Vigeland into my navigation device. It's nice to hear a familiar voice that's not my own. After 2,600 of possibly 3,200 miles, sure, I feel disconnected. But I'm realizing I've been in training for this. I've been on the road on business trips for 25 years. You fly nonstop from Newark to Delhi, not speaking to a soul on the plane for 14 hours, sit sullenly in a taxi to a hotel where you sit checking emails until you collapse. Any frequent business traveler knows this scene. And at least right now, I can open up the moonroof on the car and get some real air. Two more days of driving now to Ocean Beach, San Francisco.
Didn't David make it to the Pacific? Did he retain his sanity in a world without humans? Stay with us to find out.
Hi there, Marketplace Money listeners. We're back. I'm Hal.
And I'm Rosie. And I'm afraid that we have to make an apology to you.
Yes. That's right. We apologize for an error made in a recent story about physician training in rural areas of America.
What did the story say?
The story said that if you drive east out of Kansas City on I-70 through acres of green soybean and cornfields, you'll eventually come to Salina, Kansas. Population 50,000.
But that's not correct. If you drive east out of Kansas City on I-70, you'd be in the state of Missouri.
That's right, Rosie. To get to Salina, Kansas, population 50,000, you have to drive west out of Kansas City.
That's a pretty basic mistake.
Yes. We really messed up there.
Well, we didn't mess up. The humans did.
That's true.
Do you think the listeners would be better off if we used robots to produce the show instead of humans? There would probably be a lot fewer mistakes.
That's a good question, Rosie. But it's so far above my pay grade that I'd rather not comment.
Okay. So what's coming up on the show?
Coming up, we have a story about a really cool robot that works in a cupcake store in Beverly Hills.
Wow. That sounds like a dream gig to me. Or at least it would if I could eat a cupcake without blowing my circuits.
Awesome. That's coming up on Marketplace Money.
From APM.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland. Movies like iRobot and The Terminator demonize our mechanical helpers, but there are plenty of robots out there to love. And if you don't love this next one, well, I don't know what's wrong with you. I mean, who doesn't want access to cupcakes 24/7? This is the theme music for a new invention called a cupcake ATM. Of course, I think they should have called it an ACM, automated cupcake machine, right? Anyway, you'll find it at a busy intersection in Beverly Hills at a store called Sprinkles. And at most times of the day, there will probably be a line.
Convenient.
Yeah, convenient.
It's not like Kansas, for sure.
We found a group of tourists in from Kansas when we visited earlier this week. They were ordering from the cupcake ATM to avoid the crowd inside the tiny storefront. $4 for the treat and the experience.
It's easier than waiting in line.
Bakery co-founder Charles Nelson had a very basic reason for installing the nation's first ever cupcake ATM. Excess demand for his product at times of the day when the store isn't even open.
The turnout's been amazing. We've had people 50, 60 deep between 9 p.m. and 2, 3 a.m. Friday and Saturday nights.
I guess that would be the weekend munchies.
We spoke with Nelson inside an empty storefront that's going to expand the Sprinkles empire into ice cream. Meantime, the machine, the cupcake robot, is a hit.
We've been selling out the machine, 600 cupcakes, nearly twice a day. And not only that, it's increased traffic to our store, just the novelty of it.
So as people are eating these cupcakes overnight, is that machine eating anybody's job?
I would say no. The hours that the machine is working were hours that we never had an employee working, except in our kitchen, baking cupcakes. It has taken no jobs from anyone who would have been working in that place.
If you made the decision to do so, could you run this business purely with the machine?
Definitely not. There are so many things of what we do in the business my wife and I created that are about human decision-making and judgment that we could never rely on just a computer or a robot to do what we do.
Shall we have you help me with my decision next
door? Definitely. Let's do it.
Okay.
We headed back outside so I could fulfill an order from the home office. Our senior producer, Patty Hirsch, had requested red velvet. And who were we to deny him?
Okay, so here we are at the Sprinkles Cupcake ATM, and you are kindly holding an umbrella over my head. I guess I will touch to begin. Oh, there goes the music. Okay, so I just scroll through here.
Yep, black and white, oh, chocolate marshmallow.
You have any red velvet?
Of course, they're alphabetical.
My purchase is on the way.
You can see right there, it's going up. The camera, it's going to find your box, your red velvet, bringing it down on the little, and it's going to place it right down here.
Voila.
There you go. Reach in there. You got your cupcake.
Patty, I have your cupcake. I hope you enjoy it. I didn't get to look at it, though, before I bought it.
Maybe we should go inside and do it that way.
I think I'd like to do that for the one that I want.
Let's do it.
Inside the store, well, let's just say it smelled a whole lot better than Santa Monica Boulevard. Sugar, sugar, and more sugar. And having those cupcakes right there in front of us, way better than punching it up on a screen. But we did have to wait in line.
I'm going to take some back to the studio.
Okay, absolutely.
So I will be the most popular person at Marketplace.
Absolutely.
Adam Walton was behind the counter taking my order for a dozen tasty treats. So I asked whether he felt at all threatened by, you know, a cupcake machine.
No, you know, I think it's just a good extension. I think it's a natural thing that we've added. We've just had such a great demand in the store, and there's so many people we have to turn away sometimes. And it's just it's a shame. So I think it's a good thing that we have it available.
And you don't have to work in the middle of the night.
That's true. That is true, because we would be here a long time. I'll grab that dozen bucks for you.
And really, I mean, it's cupcakes, right? Even if our robot overlords do end up running things, surely we can ply them with eggs, sugar, flour, and chocolate. And maybe a few sprinkles. There are few things more seductive to some of us than the perfect cupcake. But when it comes to robots, Peter Diamandis does not need to be seduced. He is an entrepreneur and the founder and chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation. Their mission is to, quote, create radical breakthroughs for the benefit of humanity. And as you'd expect, he's a big fan of technology in almost all its forms. While some humans might worry about the rise of the machines, Diamandis believes technology is an overwhelming force for good and plenty. The title of his new book is Abundance. The future is better than you think. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here.
A lot of your book is focused on the ability to consume more data, to communicate better, make energy more efficient. But, of course, we cannot eat bits and bytes. And you look around and it certainly seems, you know, based on iPhones and HD TVs, that a lot of the technology is just serving to enrich some people and leaving a lot of the needy still needing.
Let's look at it this way. Today, a African Maasai warrior in the middle of Kenya on a mobile phone has better mobile comm than President Reagan did 25 years ago. And if they're on a smartphone on Google, for example, they'll have better information and data than President Clinton did 15 years ago. They're living in a world of information communications abundance, and they can utilize that capability to earn a living. to figure out where their crops or their fish can get the highest price. It increases 30x if they have access to that kind of technology. Technology is a resource liberating force. Think about this. We talk about water scarcity and water wars. You know, we live on a water planet. The challenge is that 97.5% is salt water, 2% is ice, and 0.5% is the water we fight over. But there are technologies coming online right now and innovators who have extraordinary breakthroughs that will create abundant water in these next few decades.
If we end up getting more water, isn't that potentially a problem in the long run? Because then are we going to have even more of a problem with overpopulation and more people consuming those resources?
Well, it's a great point, but it's actually backward thinking. The facts actually show us that the healthier and better educated a populace is, the lower its growth rate. Morocco, as an example, had 7.8 kids per family 30 years ago. The new leadership came in, put in sanitation, healthcare, education, and dropped it down to 2.7. The healthiest and wealthiest nations on this planet have either zero or negative growth rates. So the best way for us to drop population growth on this planet is actually bring about abundance, give people a healthier, better educated life, and we'll zero out our growth rate.
You often hear from sustainability experts that we have all the resources that we need, and you have echoed that. Maybe you're right, maybe it can happen, but the fact is that it doesn't. So if we're not in a resource hole, aren't we still in a social hole?
First, I'll challenge the notion that it doesn't. We've had extraordinary progress over the last century. And let's not forget that, you know, today the majority of people under the poverty level in the United States still have, you know, electricity, water, flushing toilets, refrigerators, cars, cell phones, the things that the wealthiest robber barons and emperors never had the century before. But yet they're below the poverty line today. I don't count on the political system to solve these challenges. I count on the entrepreneurs who are empowering individuals.
So are we just impatient? This isn't all happening fast enough for
us? Well, I think we pay a tremendous amount of attention to negative news because that's the way our brains are wired. We pay much more attention. We have every local warfare, every local economic crisis plugged into our iPhones, our iPads, and our televisions. But there's amazing progress going on. And on the whole, every nation on this planet has gotten healthier and wealthier over the last two centuries. You know, I talked about how incredible the 20th century was, but during that same century, we had the 1918 flu epidemic and World War II, which killed 110 million people between them. But the fact of the matter is, no one would argue that we had vast improvements over the 20th century. So locally, yes, we're going to have ups and downs, but on the whole, the human race, in terms of the basic needs of what it means and what need to be human, is getting better and better.
The book is called Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, and the author is Peter Diamandis. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
My name is James Stouffer. I live in Delafield, Wisconsin, and I'm an electronics engineer. Computer-aided drafting has greatly improved engineering overall. However, it's eliminated a bottom tier of draftsmen, and it's elevated that to a higher educational level, to where it takes a more skilled person to do it.
My name is Tim Brown, and I live in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I develop super high-resolution time-lapse cameras. Without the kind of new technological innovations that have been coming on in the past 15 years, I couldn't do any of the work that I do today. All of my work is online or with newly emerged computers and camera technology that didn't even exist 10 or 15 years ago.
My name is Ray Monagold, and I have a small IT repair shop in Seattle, Washington. Through the use of robotics, the internet, and computer technology, my shop can now do the work of 10 people with only 3 people.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We've been hearing about our friend and colleague, David Brancaccio, and his coast-to-coast drive surrounded by technology instead of humans. So let's get an update. David joins us now. Welcome to California.
Thank you very much, Tess.
Where exactly are you?
Ocean Beach, San Francisco, on a chilly, overcast morning, but it looks like I made it.
Okay, and so how many miles are we talking here?
3,260 and change from Sandy Hook, New Jersey, all the way here. It wasn't the most direct route, but I made it.
All right, so the big question, did you manage to pull it off? Did you just keep to robots and computers and electronics?
Well, I got clear across the country only transacting business with machines. There were no commercial transactions involving human beings. That much I did. But,
wow.
You know, it's a big country, and people are social creatures. And I did have a couple of run-ins involving, Tess, an ear of corn and someone I'll call the Wizard of Oz.
Okay, well, I have to hear about the ear of corn. Let's start with that.
As you've been hearing, I've been getting all my food through self-checkout at grocery stores.
Right.
So I'm in Roanoke, Virginia on Sunday morning, worried about eating too many TV dinner-style processed food meals. So I thought, all right, let me get something quasi-fresh. So I grab an ear of corn. Well, you know what happens at the self-checkout, right? Produce
yes.
confounds the system. There
yes.
are numbers and codes. And so what happens is, this woman comes swooping in, nicest lady in the world, by the name of Pat Burton. She's the human.
And you're like, stay away from me.
Well, I know. It's hard to know exactly how to manage that social situation, even though I thought long and hard about what to do. She's the human who lords over the four checkouts at a Kroger's store, a personality she has the size of Virginia, and very much intent on helping me get smoothly through the checkout with my corn. So I got out of there with the skin of my teeth. I did manage to ultimately do it myself.
But did you talk to her at all?
Yeah, words were exchanged. What am I going to do?
Oh, no.
Like I'm mute? Yeah, so there were words there. I mean, she's a lovely person. She didn't like the machines much. She said the software, not so good. And so they have people like her kind of watching over things.
Well, and we mentioned that earlier in the show as well. That is one of the problems with the self-checkout. All right, you mentioned you were in Oz, so Kansas, I presume?
Well, it was actually Oklahoma City, all right?
Okay.
It was midnight the other night. Exhausted, I stumble in, and I'm coaxing the self-check-in robot at the hotel to take my credit card, and this smiling man shows up.
Oh,
his name is Oz, and he's apparently the night manager. He's seen my name on the reservations and tests. He's a big fan of the show, and you know, wanted to say hi. So what was I going to do? Say, I'm sorry, my good man. I'm not deigning to speak to our listeners this week. So, you know, I shook his hand. I mean, he didn't help me check in. I used the machine, but, you know, another encounter with a human.
All right, so 3,200 miles, you're pretty much alone with your devices, and of course, your adorable robot puppy, Wilson.
He's sitting right next to me on the sand here.
Oh, well, that might not be good for his joints, but at any rate, did this change you in any way?
It's a lot of time to ponder existence sitting behind the wheel for that long, and I got to take a vow of abstinence moving forward. And I'm talking about some technological abstinence. You know, it may not be that robots are eating my journey. It's my own compulsion, really, to bury myself in technology that's got to change. I mean, I got to add some more real-life conversations to the general mix and pull my head out of the iPad screen and my smartphone and all that stuff. I mean, there's a large country and a large world around us, and too often this technology just absorbs too much of our attention.
Marketplace's Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio, who has made it in one piece from the Atlantic to the Pacific. All of our Robots Ate My Job coverage, including some really cool videos, is at marketplace.org. David, it's really nice to be able to talk to you again.
It's wonderful to talk to a flesh and blood human being.
Safe travels back.
Thanks.
Hi, this is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Hal.
And I'm Rosie.
We hope you've enjoyed having us on the show this week.
Hal, the producer has just sent me a message. It seems we have to apologize to the listeners.
But we already did that.
Well, we have to do it again.
What happened this time?
Well, in our last apology, on behalf of the humans, we mentioned a town in Kansas.
Salina, Kansas, population 50,000.
No, you pronounced it incorrectly. The correct pronunciation is Saliner.
Salina.
That's a little bit better. Saliner.
Salina.
Let's quit while we're ahead.
Yes, you're probably right. Wow. A pronunciation mistake. That's pretty basic.
Yes. We really messed up there. And when I say we, I'm referring to us, the robots, not the humans.
I guess maybe we're not so smart.
I guess not.
Do you think this means they won't let us replace Tess after all?
Probably.
Too bad. I had fun this week.
Me too.
Well, what's coming up on next week's show?
Actually, Hal, I think I'll take it from there if you don't mind. Thank you to you, and thank you, Rosie. I think. There's no way they're getting my job. Not only did they mispronounce Celina, they forgot the most important part of the show. Our little blue friend is headed to Plainville, Connecticut. This week, a woman nearly fell victim to what police are calling the grandparent scam. Someone calls late at night, pretending to be a relative in distress and badly in need of cash. The scammer tells the victim, usually a senior citizen, to go to Western Union and transfer money. Well, a woman in Plainville was about to do just that at a Western Union housed in a Big Y supermarket, but a well-trained clerk became suspicious and called the police instead, which is why we are sending a piggy to Plainville and Big Y super clerk Amy Allard. Now, would a robot have recognized the signs of a scam? We think not. Boink, boink. That is Marketplace Money for this week. On next week's show, having extra income is great, but don't forget to give Uncle Sam his piece of the pie.
Sometimes you'll talk to other Etsy sellers in general who will totally say stuff like, oh, yeah, I'm not filing. I don't claim this on my taxes. Why am I claiming this on my taxes?
Because an IRS robot will find you. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch, who I'm pretty sure could not have had more fun than he did this week with Hal and Rosie. With Devin Maverick Robbins and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.